I'm Raphael.
I'm Kirk.
And this is the Housing Problem. In previous episodes of this podcast, and please do catch up now at thehousingproblem.com, we've spoken to a who's who in the affordable housing world, working in the trenches to address and solve New York City's critical housing problem. We've spoken to members of Congress, council members, commissioners, community leaders, developers, you name it.
We've had some really phenomenal conversations with some great guests. Although we were prepping for today's show a few days ago, running through topics we wanted to discuss, and one of our producers said it was the most interesting discussion he's heard since he's been working on the housing problem. So either that bodes well for this episode, or we're going to have to start recording our prep sessions and airing those too.
They might be more entertaining, Kirk. I'm not sure.
That's right.
But I think we're going to be good for this one. We're going to speak with someone who is fully capable of geeking out with us in the best way on all of the driving factors behind the current housing problem in New York City. And I know I'm looking forward to putting him in on the spot and challenging him to help us think about some real potential solutions. I'm Raphael Sestero. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Community Preservation Corporation. I've been working in affordable housing in New York City for over 30 years, including time as the Commissioner of New York City's Department of Housing, Preservation, and Development.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. I'm President of Monadnock Development, and I'm really passionate about affordable housing and just happy to be able to talk to you folks.
And together, we have over 60 years experience in New York City working to help solve New York City's housing problem.
We have a unique opportunity today to cover a lot of ground on critical issues with someone who has had a front row seat in executing complicating affordable housing policy and projects across three of the major New York City housing agencies.
You know, Kirk, our guest is someone who has not only served at the highest level of all of these agencies that you've talked about, shaping housing policy across three mayoral administrations, doing incredible work around complex financial structures that drive housing production, but he's a really thoughtful and pragmatic practitioner and human being who thinks about the world in really interesting ways, and can't wait to have him share some of his stories with our listener.
And he's also someone we've been trying to get to come on the podcast for a while now. Eric Endelin has spent 20 years in the housing space. He currently serves as president of the New York City Housing Development Corporation, or HDC, having been appointed first by Mayor Bill de Blasio in 2016 and again by Mayor Adams in 2022.
And prior to taking on that role as president of HDC, Eric served as the deputy commissioner of development for the New York City Department of Housing Preservation Development and Development, or HPD, where he oversaw construction financing, preservation financing, housing incentives, storm recovery, and many, many other things. He also worked for many years for the New York City Housing Authority early in his career prior to joining HPD.
Eric, welcome to the Housing Problem.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us on The Housing Problem, but I have one question, and you have to be honest. Have you listened to the show before?
I have listened to so much of the show. Well, thank you, first of all, but yes, I've listened to a lot of the show, both seasons, and I'm a huge fan, and I actually found the one episode that you guys did on the bundle. This is going to sound ridiculous, but the housing as a bundle of goods, oh, yeah. I actually found kind of really inspirational and very thought-provoking, so I've listened to a lot of it. Yes.
We do lots of inspirational and thought-provoking shows, but they're all they all start with Kirk's ideas. None of them are my ideas, which is not surprising to any of our listeners. So now that we know that you've listened to the show, you know that part of our shtick here on The Housing Problem is we like to start and ask people to just sort of talk to us about their journey. Kirk and I have often talked about how he and I come from very, very different places, but we've arrived at the same place. And we think that letting our listener hear people's story is an important part of how folks get to know the people that are setting housing policy and driving housing in New York. So, you know, we mentioned that, you know, your current role at HDC, obviously you've spent time at HPD and at the New York City Housing Authority. But more than that, we're interested in sort of your personal journey and what inspired you to dedicate your entire career to helping solve the housing problem.
You know, I thank you for that. And I have found that part of this show to be one of the most interesting parts, listening to people who some of whom I've known for a long time, but have not known much of their stories or significant portions of their stories that are important to who they are. So listening to Meredith talk about, Meredith Marshall talk about his history. So let me jump in on that. And it was actually really interesting because I had to think about it, how I would frame it almost as kind of a mission statement or a journey, as you guys describe it. So I think where I landed is, you know, I kind of realized that I came out of this era of activism from the 80s and the 90s, really. It was kind of reaction formation, I think many of us had to the Reagan administration. And I think from that, I got a very profound sense of what can be described as kind of geography as destiny, this idea that we all live with, that your zip code that you're born into can be so predictive of so many outcomes mm-hmm. in your life. And that yeah. kind of what some people call geographic determinism. And the flip side to that is what people talked about a little bit as like a geographic cure, that you can move somewhere and it changes your life. You can move to, solve your problems by kind of moving. And for some people, that's like, oh, I could move to California or LA, the weather's better. And, you know, I think my whole life would be better if I moved to California or if I moved to Miami or something like that. But I think for, and the reaction to that is, you know, wherever you go, there you are. So that you're not going to get that kind of necessarily that kind of geographic cure or that kind of solving of a problem. But for other people, many of us, there is a real geographic cure, that there really is a moving to opportunity that can happen. So it's more true for some people than for other people. And I think that has had, that realization has had kind of a profound impact on my life. And I would say that New York, as it has for so many people, has provided an opportunity and a life that we probably would not have been able to have in many other places and maybe in no other place. So it's just an incredible opportunity. I think many of us, when we think deeply about it, feel very grateful to New York City and very lucky to have lived and had a career in New York City. You know, lately, and I've heard you guys talk about this too in the podcast, kind of thinking about that as a jobs to housing ratio, just to kind of bring it back to housing, this right. idea that, you know, we're kind of in this, we got a lot of jobs, we don't have enough housing, but it's really so much kind of more than that. It's really that piece of opportunity that comes in that has really created a lot of demand for people to be in New York, people like me to be in New York. And the last thing I'll say about that, I think I'd be skipping a huge part of my story, and you all know this, but kind of being out in New York as a gay person really is a big part of that kind of opportunity and that history. Mm-hmm. And I think when we looked at, I realized that so much of the activism that we had from that era was, you know, in reaction to Reagan, in reaction to the AIDS crisis and that sort of thing. And we also got to see a lot of the formation of social service organizations, the idea of housing as healthcare. We saw movements, you know, Jesse Jackson had the Rainbow Coalition, and there was right. a gesture to more openness and inclusion. And I think that sense of community and opportunity really was formative in my life. And I think that when I think about housing in New York, and when I think about the kinds of organizing that I did in my own life and groups of us did in our own lives, there's a lot of cross-understanding with organizations that had some of the same challenges. So when I think about ACT UP work, or when I think about what Nos Quedamos did, or Mid-Bronx Desperados, people who lost their neighborhood, lost a sense of community, risked that kind of opportunity, and really yeah. thought what housing stability and housing affordability really meant. So I think there's, and I'll just conclude that by saying, like, you know, I think there's, in my own story, there's a strong sense of understanding the kind of urgency, a similar moral urgency between a movement like ACT UP and a movement, for example, like Black Lives Matters or something right. like that, and the kind of housing work that has happened in many of our communities that came out of disinvestment and challenge.
Eric, one of the things that is front and center in the affordable housing world in New York, in a way it hasn't traditionally been, is the renovation of NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority properties. And so roughly, I think there's 170,000 units and almost 500,000 people who live in NYCHA properties. The Congressman Richie Torres, who grew up in NYCHA properties in the Bronx, described the conditions he grew up in and what we see often in NYCHA as a humanitarian crisis unfolding in the middle of our city. And in the affordable world, for many years, the NYCHA renovation really wasn't a part of the city's capital plan, but beginning in the de Blasio administration and now going into the Adams administration, it's really been front and center as far as an affordable housing priority. Could you talk about the evolution of NYCHA being more on the margins of the city's capital plan till now, in the present day, being right in the center of it?
Yeah, and I've heard the congressman talk about that experience, and I know exactly what you're saying. We didn't kind of outline it, but I started my New York housing career at the New York City Housing Authority from around 2000 to 2004, and we started some of the original pipeline of development. I think to really understand NYCHA and that challenge that you just described, you have to remember that NYCHA was born out of an era in which that kind of siloing, that kind of separation, that kind of segregation really was built into the system. NYCHA was formed, beginning as it's essentially a federal program with some state and city sites in it as well. But in order to get the federal support to build a NYCHA campus, you actually had to go to things like single zoning. You had to remove commercial overlays. You had to go to a single residential zone on it. You couldn't mix uses on it. A lot of times there was a trade of design for density. So you could get a tower, but then you left some buildable floor area on the table to get that kind of tower in the park look. And a lot of it was built, the idea of separation was built into it. And I think that separation,
so true,
that separate housing stock really was not just separate housing stock, separate program type of thing, but it was really like a city within a city. And you hear people talk about that, whether there's 400,000 or 600,000 people, it's a city within a city in more than just the size of the population way.
Right.
And you also hear about when the history of NYCHA is described, that a lot of even the open space on NYCHA campuses was designed to have segregation, that the parks were used by other folks in their neighborhoods, and the open space surrounding the towers in the quote park were used by the residents, and that kept a certain separation. And over time, that only got worse. I mean, when you go into the 1980s, that public housing essentially, instead of being mixed income or more mixed income, it became really a housing of last resort. And I think that set up the challenge. And then from there was just continual disinvestment. And it really is a problem that is, I think, your description of a humanitarian crisis. And that is something that's always motivated me. I've said recently that I feel like this is the preservation of public housing and the improvement of public housing is probably the high point of my housing career. I don't think there's a higher concern, cause, issue in New York City from so many perspectives, not whether it's the physical condition, the financial, but just the social justice and the fairness question of it. It's a very rich city. And to have that kind of disinvestment, that kind of disparity existing in this city is really crazy. But to your bigger question, which is really like, how did it move from that to this? It's been a long arc. I mean, it's been decades that even many of us, when I was at NYCHA, we started a pipeline of work and you could see this problem coming. We would kind of raise the red flag and we'd say, like, guys, this is going to become a crisis at some point. But people are kind of like this until ceilings start falling on people, until plumbing starts leaking in the walls, and until you get to a point where you might almost have to knock buildings down, there's the ability to kind of ignore the problem. And until you get enough political focus on it, I love hearing the congressman talk about his calling on this as well, that he has brought a political focus. And I think there's been a group of folks over time that have gradually ratcheted up that focus and have forced this to become a central issue. And in fact, in this administration, as you all well know, NYCHA for the first time, and many of us have been advocating for this for years, has been added as a central component of the overall city's housing plan, not just a separate plan or a separate track or, even a separate but equal kind of thing. It really is central to the city's housing plan.
Yeah, Eric, the piece of, what you just said that I think is just important to sort of reemphasize a little bit is that part of how we arrived here was by absolute design, right? When the Fed started the public housing program, they you know, overlaid all of this separation that you describe. I mean, I can remember, Kirk, when we were, you know, organizing in East St. Louis, you know, the idea that we were going to canvass the public housing residents was like unheard of. They weren't considered part of the neighborhood. And I think that that sort of structure has evolved over time, and people have sort of thought of public housing as over there and not part of our neighborhood. And I think we didn't think about it necessarily as part of the housing strategy of the city for a long time. And some of that, and I'm interested in your take on this, Eric, some of that was also trying to organize to get the federal government to step up in a way that they historically hadn't, to fix public housing, which ultimately, you know, frankly, wasn't their and is their responsibility. So I think your description of it as a long arc is totally right. But I think at this point, right, the city has decided that we can't wait for a feds anymore, and we're taking it on ourselves. And HDC has played such a, and you personally have played such a huge role in that over the course of the last few years.
I appreciate that. I think your description of it as by design is absolutely right. And it's even more overt than that when you consider that Robert Moses was the first head of the Housing Authority.
Right.
And it wasn't just, it was literally that housing was built in places where there was no opportunity. It was just as far out as you could. When you think about the Rockaways, and when you think about the access to job markets, and when you think about where that housing was located, it is absolutely by design in very overt ways. And when you also think about the kind of environmental justice questions that come into some of that location of housing, it's not accidental that we have what we have at this point. And your second comment too is absolutely right. I think for a long time we thought about how could we wrangle, it's largely a federal program with some state and city sites as well, but how could we wrangle the proper amount of support out of Washington in order to continue with the program? And that's just was not going to happen. So until we got to this rental assistance demonstration, the RAD program, there really wasn't a way to finance it. And the needs were just so great. I mean, when you think about capital needs that are now in the $80 billion range across that portfolio, there was nothing coming out of Washington until RAD that actually could help us to tackle that problem at the appropriate scale.
So for the listener, RAD is the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, started under the Obama administration, which allowed refinancing of public housing authority properties across the country and moving them to the more stable Section 8 rental assistance platform, and has been the engine for the renovation of housing authority properties, not only in New York, but across the country.
Yeah. And, I want to add too, because HDC is primarily a lender, kind of a debt agency, and RAD has allowed us all in New York to get fairly creative. We made some decisions early on that we were not going to use low-income housing tax credits. We were going to use kind of a participation lending and a debt model. And we've actually, that has been an incredibly interesting and informative model to use. It's actually working incredibly well. I feel like we have the opportunity, if done properly and properly managed, we could actually have a really profound success story that comes out of this pact, which is the permanent affordability commitment together. What we've said in New York City around this model of RAD and pact, this permanent affordability, is that it will be permanently affordable. All tenants will have the same rights that they have under public housing. And then we're going to have a rolling set of refis and recapitalizations that will come out of this. So it's a different model. But it also requires government to remain very vigilant in partnership with the private sector. NYCHA is not selling these properties. It's not privatizing these properties. It's all done by ground lease and by operations, private operations. And so that requires a level of asset management and vigilance that the city has really never had to undertake before. But it's incredibly important that we do it and that we are set up properly to kind of manage that responsibility. So it's a different world. And I think taking LIHTC, which so much of us have built our affordable housing careers around, the low-income housing tax credit, out of that model has allowed us to have a really, really interesting side-by-side comparison of of that experience.
I also think, full disclosure for our listener, Kirk and I are, and our organizations are partners on a rad pact project in New York City. And I actually think one of the most important things that has come out of the rental assistance demonstration program is that the fixing of public housing, the renovation of public housing, the returning public housing to being quality, affordable, permanently affordable housing is not done in isolation. It's not done in the isolation that it was built under, right? It's done in partnership with private sector, with financial institutions, with nonprofit organizations, communities, the residents themselves and the tenant associations, social service agencies. There's a community that is built around these projects that's unlike anything that's ever happened in public housing before, going back to this original conversation that we had, which is about, you know, it was, you know, it was built to be separate. And that's not what's happening under the RAD PAC program. And I think that's arguably, other than the urgent need of fixing the physical condition and the humanitarian crisis, that's arguably the most important thing that's going to happen long run with RAD PAC.
I think that's all true. And I also think that there are tremendous opportunities, you know, when the federal government moves, when these move, as Kirk described in another one of these podcasts, from Section 9, which is how we describe public housing, to Section 8, which is what the RAD financing structure is. There's a huge amount of opportunity there, too. The federal government actually releases its old declarations of trust. It's almost as though that entire asset, the land, the buildings, are repatriated back to the city of New York. And there's a tremendous opportunity in that. There's about, you know, 100 million square feet of unused floor area across NYCHA campuses, which is great. But all this stuff, and I think you all point out, is only at the speed of trust. The key thing, you know, what has happened in a lot of these where things have moved forward successfully, it's because the tenants have felt that they are in control of the process. They have options and choices. They understand what's going to happen and that it's going to improve the quality of life. And I'll say, you know, just to tie in something else, you guys touched on this in another conversation about the idea that we all think that if you have housing, the retail kind of follows. There's the old logic that like retail follows rooftops, they used to say. And we've learned that that's not true, right? We found that there you can have plenty of places where you have housing and you don't have the kind of retail or the kind of food options that you need. And so I also think there's a tremendous opportunity for us all to think about that. In fact, when we looked at the Opportunity Zone program a couple of years ago, which we had some real concerns about, one of the things we did was to make sure that we included zip codes with NYCHA property prominently, if not centrally in it, so that we could think about ways to use those kind of tax incentive programs like new markets tax credits or opportunity zones to bring supermarkets, to bring commercial, to bring other things, and not just have it be, you know, that's one of my pet peeves in New York. I really feel like New York is incredibly good at a lot of things, but we have not always been very good at coordinating a whole set of programs with the housing. So like new markets and opportunity zones should be better coordinated, in my view.
Eric, one of the things that we see now is tremendous headwinds in the affordable housing world. Obviously, resources are limited, but the cost of land, the cost of construction, higher interest rates, higher construction costs, an environment where, you know, operating costs, insurance costs are really through the roof. And when you do new construction in the way we've done it, and you try to serve lower income households, what we've seen is on projects that are hundreds of millions of dollars and projects of scale, 80 to 90% of the cost of those projects are really some form of public capital or subsidy, whether it be low income housing tax credits or subsidy from the city or state. And typically, it means less than 20% of the cost of building these projects are borne by rental income. And in looking at the fiscal situation the city is in and the tremendous amount these things cost, it's really not a sustainable model to create 400,000 to 500,000 units of housing, which is what the need is. And so I really want you to talk about those headwinds and if we can't rely on what we've done with our careers in terms of building new buildings and putting people in them to solve the housing problem, what are other tools and approaches we might employ to sort of deal with this this problem and crisis we're facing?
Yeah, it's a great, it's the central question, honestly. It's a scale question. And I think that we're not always very good at scale. I think recently we've said in New York, we probably need at least 50,000 units of new construction every year to keep up with demand and to have kind of a balanced housing market. And so how do you open up that engine and produce that kind of housing at that kind of scale? And I think we've lived in an environment for the last, since 1986 tax reform, really, let's call it that, since you want to think about it that way. We have lived in a model of housing production that relies on a certain set of inputs, one of which is nearly almost always scarce, whether it's capital or whether it's land or whether it's volume cap and tax credits at some point, whatever it may be. There's a scarcity edge that runs around the housing production model, and we have to find a way to remove that edge or think about it differently. And you know, we get into these fights about it, whether, you know, even though anyone who looks at the model would say that some of our as-of-right tax programs actually produce more housing and housing affordability than they cost, you could get bogged down in that fight. I would say this, though, and I've been thinking about this a lot more, both on the public housing side in terms of how we open up sources and think bigger about it to make sure that we get what we need there, but also on the housing production side. I think we have to think about what we traded to get the model that we have now. And when you think about what we traded away a very kind of organic, entrepreneurial-based approach to housing production, particularly at the lower end of the scale and the range, but that fostered the ability for both developers and communities to get affordable housing at the scale that they need. And let me be more specific. When we got low-income housing tax credits in 1986, one of the things we traded away was accelerated depreciation. Accelerated depreciation really was the kind of tool that many small owners and operators used to own small buildings. And when you talk, you guys have talked to some of the biggest developers, and when they tell you their stories about how they started with a four-family brownstone, or they started with, and then they did nine buildings. And when you talk to some of these folks before we were selling the tax credit and selling the depreciation, there were people, if you talk to like Peter Magistro or you talk to Mike Rooney, there were people who were bundling up and selling the depreciation just because you could and capitalizing it even before LIHTC existed. So I think what we've done is we've kicked the lowest rungs of opportunity out of the market on both the developer side and on the community side. Yeah. And I think you've got people who are experiencing that. It has become very track dependent. It's hard to break into. And there's a reason why a lot of our tax credit developers nationally, not just in New York, are all fundamentally the same. If you were an unhappy lawyer in the late 80s and you went into development, you had all the support in the world to become one of the biggest developers, because once you did one tax credit deal, you did the next one and the next one. And that kind of pipeline of support, and it was not a lot of risk. Nobody talked about, quote, capacity building. You got in, you did it, and you learned something. You did the next one a little bit better, and it got more and more competitive. And ultimately, it became like Microsoft, where it's fairly track dependent and fairly exclusionary in that sense. And so we need to get back to a model in which you can encourage people to come in at a smaller scale. And those who are genuinely entrepreneurial and skilled at it will grow and will come out of that. And I think one of the things that we really need to do is get back to a place where you get naturally occurring affordability by opening up that lower end of the market and then have people grow from there. So, and I think that answers some questions on both the community side and on the startup of development firms side as well. So I just put that out there.
Just to keep pushing on that a little bit, Eric, one of the things that I think is has driven some of this, there's a lot of factors, let's face it, right? You know, Mark Yarr on our very, very first episode of The Housing Problem, you know, said the math of affordable housing is brutal, right? It's brutal for the city. It's brutal for the resident. It's brutal for the developer. And I mean, as usual, he was completely correct. But one of the things that has driven us to this rising land costs, rising construction costs, rising cost of debt, all of that has helped drive us here. But one of the things that has driven us here is the politics of affordable housing has gotten to the place where, you know, the city had to make a decision that the vast majority of units that you're creating in new construction units that you're creating are going to, you know, very low and extremely low income rent levels. And that costs money.
Yes.
Because you're driving down the rents that you're allowed to lease units at. And so I guess my question to you now, having operated in that world now and facing the current economic situation, has the pendulum swung too far on that? Do we need to start thinking a little differently about how we're doing this? Do we need to start overlaying some other programs like rental assistance, operating supports of some kind to help still house folks that are extremely low income, but not drive the cost of the amount of subsidy you have to put into buildings on the capital side up so high?
Yeah, there's so much in that question. But yes, I think the answer is yes. And the math on affordable housing is brutal, but it's particularly brutal in New York. And for a couple of reasons, we actually have almost, we've set up a system that creates false scarcity across a couple of things. It's very difficult to build. It's very difficult, even though we're kind of from a planning perspective, we're kind of an as of right city. But that doesn't mean it's easy to get projects approved and, right, and into construction. So land is expensive. We're also, we live in an era in which, and again, this goes back to the 80s. After the Second World War, we had progressive tax brackets that went, you know, from Eisenhower on into the 80s, tax brackets that went up marginally higher. Your 10 millionth dollar that you earned was taxed more than the person who's earning $30,000 a year. We capped that at 38-39%, and then we gave away other things. So the money that we actually need to do these things that actually benefit working class people, middle class people, and poorer people just isn't there, to your point about needing money. But then we've layered on these kinds of senses of scarcity where it's difficult to build. There's a huge amount of our stock that's kind of stuck in regimes that aren't particularly flexible. And so we've got to think about ways that we can bring new resources to bear to do that. I think your point about rental assistance is key. Quite honestly, I think rental assistance is going to be, it already is, it's the front edge of a universal kind of basic income approach, right? When you think about it,
that's right.
Providing a housing voucher really is the front edge of some sort of income assistance. And I think that we're going to see that become more and more critical as we think about this problem. So for sure, there's so much you could say about that though. And the last thing I'll say about it is, you know, we get into these fights about democratic socialists and all that kind of stuff. We already live in a system, quite honestly, that is a democratic market socialism, but that the social dividend that people fight over is delivered to the tax code, right? There are a lot of people who get a lot of benefit through the tax code without ever feeling like they took a social dividend. I think we've all talked about home ownership as one of those places where it's a huge affordable housing program for some people, mainly the middle class, the upper middle class, and the wealthy. And it's larger than any other affordable housing program, but no one ever feels like they're taking any kind of government largesse or any kind of social program, but it really is a huge social program.
Right. For the listener, through what Eric's talking about is the mortgage interest deduction, and the fact that homeowners all across the country are able to deduct the interest they pay on their mortgage, which is essentially a federal subsidy for housing policy. It's the biggest federal subsidy for housing policy in the country.
And you know, Raphael, I listened to that too, but we don't need to add to that the fact that our mortgages, our 30-year mortgages, are insured by the federal government,
right?
Which makes them even cheaper. And then the last thing, and this is the crazy thing, but it's one of the biggest tax incentives. The when you own your house and you've paid it off, you're 60 years old, the tax-free rental equivalent benefit of that, if you're 60 years old and you have a house now that you paid $70,000 for that would now rent for $10,000 a month, that's $120,000 in income equivalents, rental equivalents, that you would have to earn and would be taxed if you were a renter. Right. You get that tax free. So when you start piling, you know, we just talk about the mortgage deduction as though it's the big deal. The whole set of benefits that inure to people in home ownership is so big and so invisible to most people. Everyone feels like, I earned this house, I bought this house. I'm not saying you didn't, but you got to realize what the system is delivering behind the scenes for a lot of people and is not delivering for other people.
Eric, we have one more major topic to cover on marketing and lease up, but I can't resist bringing up SROs because, you know, my parents lived in an SRO for many years coming to New York, and our homeless, our permanent supportive housing product type for the last 20 plus years, a product type of choice, I'll describe it as, has been studio apartments with each apartment having its own kitchen and bathroom. And this has sort of been my pet peeve, not because I think people are not deserving of the dignity of living in an apartment of that kind. It's just in a scarcity, having an ability to afford that is just not there. And so, and part of the reason that, you know, New York was able to manage as well as it did in the, you know, first part of the 20th century was the stock of legal SROs, which exceeded 250,000, which is now under 35,000. So I wanted you to talk for a minute or two about whether you see a return to some type of SRO as part of the toolbox going forward in a more formal way than it has been to date in the housing agencies.
Yeah, I'm a big believer. I'll be just very straightforward about that. I think it's critical. I think that policymakers and practitioners kind of gave up too much when we all thought that certain problems could be solved or wished away or whatever you want to say, that we would just get through it and we would not have to tackle, for example, homelessness or a range of housing stock for an extended period of time. And I think we kind of gave up the fight on that. And we thought that we would just solve it and it would disappear. And that's not been the case. And I think what we've learned is that we need a range of housing solutions across the entire spectrum. You can label it however you want to think about it, gateway housing models or however you want to describe it. But I do think that there are pieces of that housing stock that we should recover, that we should understand what that kind of equilibrium level is, what we would need to have and what we should offer people so that people can work through a range of opportunities across different periods of their lives. I mean, I remember looking at the Lower East Side years ago and we had a consultant. We were talking about some of the NYCHA stuff and that consultant's like, you could rent studio apartments all day long on the Lower East Side. But that, you know, that was true and we should think about ways to do that as a component of it, while we're also tackling issues around family housing and larger units and that sort of thing. So I absolutely think having that range, including SROs, is a key part of how we think about solving this problem. And I think keeping control of it, what we've seen, because we have a right to shelter in New York City, what we've seen is that sometimes we compare the wrong things. We're comparing what does it cost to build this or to control that, or when in the de Blasio administration, when we were actually buying buildings to make sure we had control of some space to actually reduce that shelter population, people are like, it's expensive. The question becomes, expensive compared to what? What does spot demand for shelter, right to shelter on a given evening look like when you got to put a family into a hotel room or something, right? You might as well leverage that. And I think we've become more sophisticated. I think DHS and folks there and others integrating the overall housing model and saying, expensive compared to what? And actually think about it in that broader question. We do that a lot in housing. We make the wrong analysis. We think about the trades very too narrowly.
Yeah. No, I totally, that is the absolute right frame, right? Expensive compared to what?
Yep.
And so many times things get criticized and you're not thinking about what you're comparing it against. And I think that's 100% the way we need to be thinking about that. And frankly, there's been lots of people who've been talking about this for years. And I do agree that advancements have been made, but there's so much more that could be done if we were, you know, really willing to be aggressive in how we thought about the dollars that we're putting in to a shelter system now. And if you turned those dollars into other things, what would the world what would the world look like? And I think we're making progress. And I've always said that housing policy is evolutionary, not revolutionary for the most part.
So. It's true. I would just add to that too. Like I think we were in that same mode right now around office conversion.
Yeah. Exactly.
You can say what's it worth to trade to convert? What should we get out of it? But the real question is, what does it mean to have swaths of your city remain dark?
Right.
Like
that's right.
Are we getting the trade right?
Yeah. So on that, in a similar vein, I think one of the things that we wanted to try to dig into a little bit, you know, with you, Eric, because of all the people we've had, you might be the one who can geek out on the intricacies of housing policy better than with Kirk and I than any of them. And so, you know, we've talked a lot about the difficulty of building housing. We've talked about, you know, the cost issues. But one of the things that I think we don't talk enough about, and this, you know, this has been the truth for years, is that once a building gets built, that's the challenges don't end there. It can take as much as 12 months to fill a vacant apartment and start collecting rent. And there's an economic cost to that, and there's a social and human cost to that, that I think that we don't talk about enough. And Citizens Housing and Planning Council, you know, a couple of years ago put out a study that talked about sort of the bureaucratic hurdles that drive some of those lease up delays. You know, some progress has been made. But how should we, you know, as a housing community, think about this issue of, even though all of our challenges in New York, we still build and start construction on more housing than any other city, subsidized housing than any other city in the country. But how should we be thinking about turning some of our attention to making sure that units are occupied more quickly and that we're actually filling and solving people's housing needs as units come online and are available?
Yeah, I think about this in a couple of ways, and I appreciate the question. My first reaction to the idea of that was, you can't. And I think you heard some other people, Jessica Katz said this too. We actually have a system that's built to have these kind of delays built in. So
right.
The question becomes, how do you undo that system? But so first, let me say, if you just look and say, we have a frictional vacancy, which is like the number of units that are built but are empty because we haven't gotten through that process, and it's 1,000 units, right? That's a rolling 1,000 units, which means it's constant. Like, even though some units get filled, others are not filled. So if you've got this rolling frictional vacancy of even just 1,000 units, which is not unheard of in New York, and it can be higher, when you capitalize that over the fact that it's rolling, meaning you, that's worth a couple $100 million. I don't think people fully appreciate that it's worth a couple $100 million to actually have those, have people move into those units, begin paying rent, and actually start to deal with all the sources that built those units and to actually give people a place to live. So just reducing that frictional vacancy from 1,000 to say 500 is, you know, saves you $100 million right there. But the thing I would then go on to say about that is, let's remind ourselves that that doesn't solve the problem. That's 500 units, right? That's not, you know, that's because we just improved the process. But the first step of that, and this is something that we've been talking more with the city about, not everything is a technological problem, but this quite honestly is. It's a little ridiculous. We live with a system, a Housing Connect system, that is kind of like, I don't want to offend anyone who worked on it, but it's kind of in that model of good enough for government work. It's kind of little bit scraped together, not really, you know, we live in a world where Amazon can deliver a package to your door the next day, take a picture of it and send it to you and everything else. There are ways that we could actually spend the proper amount of investment and get to a place where we could reduce that frictional vacancy. So I think that's the first thing that we should do. The second thing is, it goes back a little bit to the way we think about risk and how we treat residents in this, that we should actually be in a process where we move people in the front end more quickly and we audit on the back end and we actually solve the problem that. But the last thing I'll say about this, and this isn't, please don't, because I've peppered these comments throughout the conversation. Yeah. I'm not anti-tax credit, but we got to, it's important. We got to remember, you know, some people think of tax credit equity as low cost equity because it's got like maybe an 8% yield right now or something on it. But the truth is, on a risk adjusted basis, it's not actually that cheap, because the reason it's risk adjusted is that it comes with so much regulation and so much of a, a hammer on it. So that's a very hard system. When you operate LIHTC housing, when you operate tax credit housing, it comes with a set of rules that almost demand you behave in that way, right? So finding a way out of that, fixing that kind of regulatory regime, I think is going to be part of that challenge. And I think some of that goes back to finding out ways to do mixed income housing, naturally occurring affordable housing, that type of model.
Well, I also think, you know, and I'm going to seriously date myself in the affordable housing world by talking about this. But, you know, when I first started in this were being done, the marketing process, there was a lottery system, all of the, you know, incomes were checked, all of the work was still done. But the process had no, I mean, we didn't even know what technology was back in those days. The applications were sent to a P.O. box, and, you know, they were pulled out of the P.O. box and put into a black garbage bag. And then they were, you know, with multiple different people watching, they were pulled out in order and written on a log, right?
Yep.
It couldn't have been any less technologically advanced, right? But there was some friction in the system. Right.
Yeah.
So that, you know, part of the problem here is it's so easy to apply that you can just fire off a million applications. And maybe that's good for the consumer. I'm not sure, but it's not good for the consumer if it's taking 12 months to go through the process and finish, you know, finish the leasing up. And it's not good for the city if it's taking us that long to occupy units.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, the same 100,000 people can drop an application on 10 different projects, right?
That's right.
And at first we all celebrate, oh, there's 100,000 applicants, but they're all the same 100,000 across 10 different developments.
Yeah.
And that actually leads to exactly the problem you talked about. I mean, so much of what we do is tries to be anti-fraud and tries to then incorporate technology. And sometimes we kind of overshoot that goal, actually. So,
I think that's right. I think at some level there's, and particularly with the tax credit where there's so many other watchdogs looking at every single thing, at some point, you know, we have to get back to being, you know, in the business of serving the people of the city and not protecting ourselves from audit risk.
Yeah. And I think we can get there on that question. I don't think that's out of reach. I think it's something that we should do. But again, that's not going to get us all the way there on the supply question. The more central one is the one you all raised earlier, which is basically this question of supply and how we get to that point. And I think there's, you know, I'm also the kind of experience that I talked about at the beginning of the interview of my background and my kind of view of the world has also led me to be super practical and pragmatic. I don't live in a world of hyper idealism. I kind of think you get half today and you come back tomorrow and get the second half. And there's a long arc of justice in the universe, and incrementalism is not a bad word. It's actually the way you get things done, and you build on it and you bring people along. And I think that's a model where that can kind of happen.
So since you brought it up, and I know we only have a couple minutes left, but I'm going to go off our script a little bit here, because I think, you know, you mentioned it earlier, you know, we gave up in order to get things like the low-income housing tax credit. We gave up, you know, a relatively low barrier to entry way for somebody to get involved and build a, you know, a 4, 6, 8 unit building. And many, many, many towns and communities in Connecticut and New Jersey are doing that. They're building rental housing and they're building it aggressively. And we're not in New York City. So part of what I'm interested in your take on this is that we get so caught up in these battles over tax incentives for big, large developments and large scale developments. And we kind of forget that the incremental approach of creating a way for somebody to build a 10 unit building as of right in a neighborhood in New York is a positive thing for the housing stock. Is that a crazy, you know, notion? Is that a crazy approach to trying to get to supply?
I don't think it is. I actually think it's critical, because I think you can do things at the local level, at what feels like an organic 5 units here, 8 units there, the way it was done more often, that those things cumulatively mean a lot. And we've moved to a world where we actually have kind of incorporated affordable housing or corporatized it or brought in big institutional investors who can change their view of the world in a very short period of time. And you can see someone step into the world, the housing market, and be an investor and then step back out of it. And we all kind of swing with that in the wind kind of thing. I think if you've got a system that is delivering at the community level, at the grassroots level, in the way that we kind of talked about, you get to much better supply. You also get to, by the way, you know, the world that used to exist where a teacher would manage a three-family house down the street over the summer and had affordable units because they knew tenants and they had people living there for 10 years. That was a world that worked for a lot of people. And that's not just in New Jersey. That was Brooklyn. That that was, you know, a lot of places. But many of our experiences of cities were actually built on that kind of smaller model. You look at Boston, the three-family house in Boston was a key thing. The other key thing about that kind of housing, it is the first rung of ownership for many people. You maybe bought it and you lived in the smallest apartment, you had a family, you moved to the bigger apartment and you rented it, and you took those benefits, and that kind of stuff got wiped out. So I think if you think about the idea that organic production and those sets of relationships can manage it, you solve a lot of problems at that level. Instead of us worrying about, like, did we get $2 billion here or $10 billion? Are we going to get more volume cap or whatever? That's all important. And in fact, in New York City, someone said, and it's true, like, you can't imagine that you're going to get everything that you need from the market, but you also can't imagine that you get the scale that you need in a place like New York City without the market. So we do have to think about big programs in New York to get to 50,000 units a year. But that's not the only way we should be thinking about it. It shouldn't be happening only in blocks of 150 units or 200 units. There should be an ability for people to own and operate four-family, five-family, a small 10-unit building. And I think we can bring back some of those incentives. They're not that complicated, quite honestly. We all focus on private activity bonds. We focus on LIHTC. Talk about depreciation schedules. Right. Talk about you know, what the marginal tax rates are for people. Right? Actually encourage people. And that's the other thing that's great about it is a lot of people realize they loved it and were good at it at that level. Yeah. And then go on to do the stuff that we talk about, the 200 unit bond deal or the 500 unit multi-phase development. So it's not kicking out the lowest rungs of the ladder, I think, are a critical element to solving this problem.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense.
All right. Can we just greatly appreciate you sharing your thoughts and coming on the podcast. As we thought before we invited you, it was an amazing opportunity to hear from somebody who's sort of played a critical role over the last two decades in trying to help solve the housing problem. So thank you so much for being on today with us.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for joining us. It was great.
So it's always good to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Eric Enderlin. What a great conversation. He's been a leader in our industry and you know, continues to provide that leadership as president of the New York City Housing Development Corporation. We really hope that these conversations lead to a greater understanding of the housing problem and its potential solutions. We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Housing Problem. I'm Rafael Sestero.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. You can contact us and find out more about affordable housing in New York City and nationally at thehousingproblem.com.
And please remember, please subscribe and share The Housing Problem, because the more we explore the housing problem together, the better chance we have of finding the housing solution.
Produced by Paul Jamali. Executive producers, Rafael Sestero, Kirk Goodrich, Eric Biederman, and Tom Corsillo. The Housing Problem Podcast is a top content production for Merino PR.